This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Protecting the planet is a principle that goes back to biblical times. In America today, though, environmentalism is often seen as a partisan issue, a left-wing ideological stance. But in other parts of the world and at different points in history, environmentalists have also had some right-wing motivations too. Amid the global coronavirus pandemic, many people have pointed out dramatic improvements to air and water quality from industry slowing down and fewer people going to work. Some environmentalists have said the economy should remain closed to give the planet a, quote, chance to heal. In March, an Australian author named Keaton Joshi wrote a viral blog post that called this form of coronavirus environmentalism, quote, lazy ecofascism. Dozens of outlets reported on the phenomenon of ecofascism, and last month Google Trends showed that searches for the term tripled since last August, when the El Paso shooter described himself as an ecofascist. A historian at Marquette University co-wrote the book on ecofascism, and we wanted to find out whether he thinks the term is used appropriately today. In part one of two in our ecofascism series, Lake Effect's Julian Haida asked Professor Peter Staudenmayer about ecofascism's roots in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy.
Professor Staudenmayer, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So, in 1995, you co-authored a book called Ecofascism: Lessons from the German Experience, and that kind of helped introduce the term ecofascism into broad use. It's pretty popular these days. Just for sake of a primer, what is ecofascism? In one of your essays on the history of German fascism, you write, quote, while protecting flora, fauna, water, and soil, the Nazis also exterminated millions of human beings. So is that the gist of ecofascism?
That's the gist of how I use the term. But like any other important concept or term, it means different things to different people. And I don't have, neither I nor my co-author from 25 years ago, Janet Beal, neither one of us has we don't have a copyright on the term. We didn't even invent the term, although you're right that we did help popularize it by using it as the title of a book. So the way I use the term ecofascism these days is pretty different from what a lot of other people mean by it. In my usage, I try to be more historically specific. I think it makes sense to use a term like that, which is a powerful term. I think it makes sense to use a term like ecofascism to refer to people who are both ecologically minded in some broad sense, who are genuinely committed to some kind of environmental program, and who are simultaneously affiliated in some way with the far right or with the radical right, as it's sometimes called. When both of those conditions are fulfilled, then I think it can make sense to use a term like ecofascism. Whereas I don't use that term, or I try not to use the term, when we're talking about similar phenomena that tend maybe in that direction, but that aren't really fully fascist, so to speak. So sometimes people use the term, reasonably enough, to refer to anti-immigrant sentiment presented in an environmentalist context. And even though I'm very, very critical of those forms of anti-immigrant arguments, I don't see any logic to them, I sometimes shy away from calling them examples of ecofascism unless we can show that those same arguments or the people making those arguments are also falling prey to the kind of racial myths that are more common on the far right or in the fascist milieu.
Now, when you say fascism, I think a lot of people take issue with the way that the term is used in the 21st century. A lot of scholars divide the term neo-fascism as being post-World War II and fascism being Mussolini in Italy, Hitler in Germany. Can you give me a little bit of a Cliff Notes version of their approach to the environment? I think a lot of people don't know that early fascism with a capital F, as we saw in Italy or Germany at the beginning of the last century, did have quite an environmental priority. What was that like, and how much of that has to do with the destruction of the industrial age that came in the 19th century?
That is an excellent historical question, and it's a little hard to answer because things like Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy, even though we tend to think of them in a sort of, we have a sort of monolithic image that they were dictatorships and everybody did whatever they were told. In reality, both of those regimes, they were dictatorships, but both of those regimes had different factions within them. They had different currents or different strands within them. And those different factions, different fascist factions in Italy, different Nazi factions in Germany, they constantly disagreed with each other. They were always jostling with each other, each one trying to get the upper hand. And in both regimes, but especially in the German example, there were some tendencies within the Nazi Party that were strongly committed to what we would now think of as an environmental program, but only some factions. Other factions within the Nazi Party had absolutely no use for those green concerns whatsoever. So when I talk about, and when other historians talk about ecofascism in the context of Nazi Germany, we're not necessarily referring to the entire regime as a whole. We're instead pointing at those specific tendencies within Nazism that went in an environmental direction. But as far as those tendencies go, there were many of them. Some Nazis were very committed to forms of organic farming. Organic farming was still relatively new in its modern form. It emerged in the 1920s in Germany, and Hitler came to power in 1933, so it was still relatively new. But a number of Nazis, including some very powerful Nazis, were quite supportive of organic farming for a variety of reasons, sometimes because they thought it was better for the health of the soil or for the health of people eating food, but sometimes simply because it was a way for them to get around the need to import petroleum products that you'd have to use for various chemical additives, et cetera, et cetera. So there were a lot of different reasons, whether it was autarky or ecological responsibility. Another example from the Nazi period is a group of mid-level Nazi officials called Advocates for the Landscape. That was their official Nazi title. And their job was to try to make sure that the various public works projects that Hitler's regime was instituting, both in Germany itself and across the occupied portions of Europe after Nazi forces started to conquer the rest of Europe. The job of the Advocates for the Landscape was to make sure that those projects were done in an environmentally responsible way. So those are just two examples of ways in which some parts of the Nazi regime followed a kind of ecological program.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Peter Staudenmeier. He is a professor of history at Marquette University. His book, co-authored with Janet Beal in 1995, is called Ecofascism: Lessons from the German Experience, and ushered the term ecofascism into broader use. Now, you also outline in your work, and I think a lot of people are familiar when they look into this history that you're describing, with the Nazi agricultural minister, Richard Walther Dare. And he came up with a slogan, blood and soil, but that slogan was also applied to an expansionist ideology, right? Nazi Germany wanted to take over much of the world, and a lot of that had to do with new imperial and colonial ambitions, and colonial ambitions are about extracting resources. So how did that ideology, blood and soil, that was used, for example, in the expansion of Germany to the east, where the land is very rich, with the perhaps destructive ideology that is part of colonialism and imperialism of extracting resources for their immediate use and the environmental impacts of that?
That's a very important part of the history that I study. And you were right to point out the obvious contradiction involved there. That contradiction is real. It's a contradictory history. It's not just that, it's not as if we are somehow misunderstanding what the Nazis meant by blood and soil. The problem is that the Nazis' own conception of it was flatly internally contradictory. Dare, for what it's worth, did not invent the term blood and soil. He borrowed that term. It had already been circulating in the far right milieu in Germany since the mid-1920s, but he took it and ran with it. And he's the one, when he became Minister of Agriculture in 1933, he's the one who established the phrase blood and soil as a major part of Nazi propaganda. There are interesting ongoing historical debates about the extent to which Daré was able to put any of that stuff into practice, which is a different question. But at the very least, at the level of ideology, what blood and soil was supposed to stand for in a Nazi context was the putative connection between a particular people or a particular race, to use Nazi terminology, and the soil or the territory that they occupied. So the obvious counterexample from a Nazi point of view was Germans versus Jews. The Nazis thought that Jews were a people without any territory, without any connection to the land. Daré routinely referred to Jews as nomads. They didn't have a connection to any soil. Whereas he believed that good German farmers from good German racial stock, that they had over the centuries developed a caring relationship with the soil, and that if you wanted to respect both the nation or the people and the soil, that you had to maintain that supposed connection between blood on the one hand and soil on the other hand. The way that Nazis like Daré were able to justify the expansionist program in the East, and in Daré's case, it was more than just justifying. Daré was an expansionist in his mind before Hitler even came to power. Daré was already preaching a racial program and conquest in the East before 1933, before the Nazis were in charge of Germany. And the way that Daré squared those things in his mind was he believed that the German people had a long-standing historical right to expand, to take over more territory, because they were the ones who were best adapted to caring for the soil, to making it fruitful, to creating a greener Europe that would feed the people who deserved to be fed. And that meant, at the same time, excluding everybody else, Jews, Poles, Slavs, what have you.
Now, Professor, I wanted to ask you a little bit about today. People have been invoking this term, ecofascism, that you helped kind of spread, with regards to some of the reactions that people have had to coronavirus shutdowns. People from politicians to outlets such as The Hill to the World Economic Forum are sharing statistics that air quality across the world has improved because factories have shut down. One Twitter user called Thomas Schultz sent out a viral tweet in March that said, quote, air pollution is slowing down, water pollution is clearing up, coronavirus is Earth's vaccine, we are the virus. It received hundreds of thousands of likes, thousands of retweets. So when you hear we are the virus, as in we humans are destroying the environment, when you hear that, what kind of analogous do you see to these historical ideologies that we've been talking about?
Unfortunately, those ideas of humans as a virus or humans as a cancer or humans as the problem that plagues our planet, unfortunately, those ideas are very common and very old. I agree with you that we're now seeing a revival of a lot of those ideas because of the current ongoing crisis. But the underlying belief has been there for generations after generations. And it's been, unfortunately, in my view, it's been a fairly common element in environmentalist discourse in a lot of different countries for more than a century and a half now. From a historical point of view, environmentalism did not just magically appear in the 1960s. Its roots extend back, at the very least, back into the 19th century. And a lot of environmentalists in the United States, in Europe, and in other parts of the world, they have been tempted by that notion of blaming all of humankind for the very real environmental destruction that some human societies and that some human institutions inflict on the natural world. The reason that is a problematic idea is simply that there's not really any such thing as one humankind. The human species is divided up into all sorts of different groups, and those groups are treated very, very differently by the various societies that we live in. So one of the tropes that we've seen recently with the notion that humans are the virus and Corona is the cure. One of those tropes suggests, for example, that if you want to reduce the human footprint on the planet, the carbon footprint, if you want to reduce that by 25%, well, all you have to do is reduce the human population by 25%. It seems like that is a sensible claim. But when you think about it, you realize there's a crucial error there. The assumption is that each human being has the same carbon footprint as any other person does. And that is flatly untrue. People who live in wealthier countries, people who are wealthier within the countries that they live in, people who live in a certain way, et cetera, all of those things have an enormous impact on any individual's carbon footprint. So the notion that we could just reduce this to a quantitative question, fewer human beings would supposedly mean better outcomes for the planet, that is a mistake. It's a mistake both from a historical point of view, and if I may say so, I think it's a mistake from an environmental point of view as well.
Peter Staudenmeier is an associate professor of history at Marquette University and the co-author of Ecofascism, Lessons from the German Experience. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Tomorrow on the show, Julian will conclude the conversation with Professor Staudenmeier, who will consider where ripples of historical ecofascism can be found today.